I'd like to welcome you all to this morning's CPD program, Michael Green's List. My name is Paul Santa Maria, and I'm going to introduce our two presenters this morning. To my immediate right is Megan Fitzgerald, a barrister, and Rupert Waters, another barrister on Michael's List. And you will see some short biographies of Megan and Rupert in the materials, and I won't read those. You might read them for yourselves, but you'll see that each of our presenters has substantial experience in the subject matter of our discussion this morning, focusing on the regulatory aspects of the practice of law, and also issues that arise from time to time in practice, which in some cases lead to claims of professional negligence against solicitors and barristers. And so I think it's a timely topic because we need to be reminded of our the way in which the Parliament regulates our practice as lawyers and our duties and responsibilities. The structure of this morning's seminar is perhaps to move away from the traditional lecture format and to invite and to promote discussion, because as I look around the room, I see there is a very substantial body of accumulated experience in the practice of the law. And so what I'm going to do is to suggest, and I know that Megan and Rupert will agree, is to promote some discussion between the floor and this panel about issues that arise from time to time. What we would like to do is to spend the first 25 minutes or so competing with the construction works behind us in discussing the regulatory framework. Then we might have a short 5 or 10 minute break, and if I'm right, in the materials you will see that there are two case scenarios included as part of the materials, and those scenarios will form the backdrop of the discussion that we're going to have about issues arising around professional negligence. I read both of those scenarios late last night. I found it very difficult to get to sleep after reading them because I thought, there but for the grace of God go I. What a terrible situation to be in either of those two scenarios, particularly the first one. But I think they're interesting and thought-provoking, and we'll get to those in the second part of the discussion this morning. So I'm going to ask Megan and Rupert now to commence the discussion by providing us with an overview of the regulatory framework in Victoria of the practice of the profession. Megan.
Thanks, Paul. I'll start by just giving you a very basic overview of the regulatory system. Now, the first thing to think about is the Legal Profession Act, which essentially governs all of our conduct and our admission to practice in Victoria. It covers a number of things, including the admission of lawyers and the continuing admission of lawyers, so whether you can be have your practicing certificate renewed. It also covers a number of things to do with getting things right. It makes provision for the making of rules, which I'll talk about in a moment, and it covers the major topics like trust money and trust accounting and costs disclosure and review. It also provides for the Legal Services Board, the Legal Services Commissioner, and the legal practice list at VCAT. The Act makes provision for the making of rules, and for solicitors those rules are the Professional Conduct and Practice Rules 2005, which the LIV produces. For barristers it's the Victorian Bar Incorporated Practice Rules, and those are rules that are made binding under the Act. The rules, generally speaking, include a number of motherhood statements about not engaging in conflict, not behaving in a dishonest way, those sorts of obvious things. But they also are quite a helpful source where you do come across something a bit more complex or troubling. For example, in the solicitor's rules, there are quite clear guidelines on what to do if your instructions are withdrawn and another solicitor is instructed and there's a request for your file to be handed over and you know, whether you can claim a lien in that situation. The Act also provides for the making of regulations. Now, the regulations provide the nuts and bolts to the trust accounting practices and to costs disclosure and costs review. The Act also creates the Legal Services Commissioner. Now, some of you in the room may be familiar with the Commissioner, but essentially the Commissioner's there to investigate complaints. And complaints can be made on two different bases. The first is civil complaints, so those are complaints about costs up to $25,000, and complaints about loss. So essentially the Commissioner can consider small negligence claims or breach of contract claims up to the $25,000 limit as well. With respect to those civil disputes, if the Commissioner can't resolve them by either mediation or correspondence between the parties, the Commissioner then has the power to give the parties their rights to take the dispute to VCAT. And that's how a lot of the costs disputes make their way to VCAT. And unfortunately, that means that VCAT involves a lot of self-represented litigants fighting cost disputes that quite often are more complex than would be desirable. The matters can't be brought to VCAT under the Legal Profession Act unless the Commissioner has given rights. So then you find that the legal practice list is also considering small negligence claims or breach of contract claims or costs disputes under the Fair Trading Act or the newly named Australian Consumer Law and Fair Trading Act. The other thing that the Commissioner does is consider disciplinary complaints. And when a client usually, or sometimes the Commissioner, becomes aware of conduct that is of concern and brings an own motion investigation, the Commissioner will then investigate the conduct of the lawyer. And in the vast majority of cases, if the lawyer gives a thorough response and an explanation, provides some hopefully helpful file notes or letters of advice, the Commissioner will deal with the matter quite quickly and often dismiss it or deal with it in a relatively moderate way, so with maybe a reprimand or something of that sort. So I guess the thing to take from that is if you do happen to get one of these letters from the Commissioner that says a complaint has been made, please provide your response and any supporting documents, it's really, really worthwhile providing a thorough response and any documents you have to try and nip it in the bud as quickly as possible. The Commissioner, once that investigation process is over, if there is a reasonable basis for a finding at the tribunal of professional misconduct or unsatisfactory professional conduct, the Commissioner will then take the matter to VCAT and make an application for disciplinary orders against the practitioner. Now, generally speaking, unsatisfactory professional conduct, which is the lower form of professional misconduct, is defined by the Act, and it's generally speaking conduct that falls short of what you might expect from a reasonable practitioner. And professional misconduct is similarly defined and is essentially just same sort of conduct but worse. The decisions in the tribunal and the courts have also preserved common law professional misconduct, and that's very much a similar thing. It's conduct which would reasonably be regarded as disgraceful or dishonourable by solicitors of good repute and competency. Now, the tribunal hears a number of applications by the commissioner about that sort of conduct. And, of course, you have your most extreme type of case, which is your Mr. Brott or your Mr. Forster, where those cases involve things like billing clients twice for the same work or acting without any form of instructions in disputes. But the tribunal also hears the more understandable sort of situations where things have spiralled out of control to some extent for a practitioner, and the normal course of events isn't to interfere with anyone's practising certificate, but quite often there'll be a reprimand or a fine imposed for situations where the conduct of the practitioner just hasn't been quite up to par. The other thing that I'll just touch on in terms of our regulatory scheme is the Legal Practitioners Liability Committee. The LPLC is the professional indemnity insurer for virtually all solicitors and barristers in Victoria, and they get involved when a civil claim is made against a practitioner, so generally speaking a negligence claim or a breach of contract claim for damages. The LPLC step in and insure those claims, and they don't cover your disciplinary disputes or defalcations, other sorts of complaints, fines and investigations. I'll pass over now to Rupert, who will give a bit of an overview of the basics of the law of negligence as it applies to us.
Just before you do, sorry, Megan, I'm just wondering, when matters are at VCAT and there are serious allegations of professional misconduct made against a practitioner, who tends to hear those cases at VCAT? Is it are they senior members, or can you?
Yes, there are a number of different members who hear those matters. Generally speaking, at the moment, the vast majority are heard by senior member Smithers. And there are Mr. McNamara and Judge McNamara, I should say now, and senior member Butcher also hear a lot of those matters. My understanding is, generally speaking, they'll put someone managing that list who is a professional lawyer of long standing, and they're dealt with in a very methodical and calm manner, generally speaking.
Yeah, thanks, Megan. Rupert, sorry I interrupted you.
Thank you. So I'm just going to start with a brief overview of negligence. I mean, negligence situations are so fact-bound that there's a limit to what I can really say beyond some general points, which hopefully will help you if you do happen to be on the receiving end of a writ of negligence. First point, of course, is to contact the LPLC as soon as possible. So it's obviously the case that a solicitor owes a duty to take reasonable care in the exercise of their professional practice, and that duty is the same whether in contract or in tort, at least in New South Wales, which is where Hayden and NRRA comes from. Now, that duty importantly includes a requirement to warn of inherent risks in the transaction, although what is an inherent risk to some extent depends on the nature of transaction. So in the case of Credit Lyonnais, which is referred to in the document, you had a situation where a client wanted to extend the right to exercise a break option, but the terms of the contract did not in fact permit that extension. So the solicitor was briefed, and they claimed that their instructions were simply to write to the other side and say, can we extend the break option? They claimed not to have been instructed to advise whether or not the break option was in fact extendable. And the Court of Appeal in England said, well, if there's an obvious critical point you need to raise that with your client, notwithstanding that your client might not have raised that issue with you as regards one they want advice on. Hayden and NRMA, it was a bit more of a general point. There is probably no general obligation to just advise on the possibility that the law may change, because that's the sort of inherent risk. That is an inherent risk, but it's a more generalized risk. But again, if you're aware of anything that says that the law in an area might change, then you are likely to have to advise on that risk. Now, the scope of the duty is ordinarily defined by a solicitor's retainer, but it is possible that in some circumstances it goes further. In Hawkins and Clayton, Justice Dean said that you may have to advise on, for example, the risk of economic loss arising from a particular transaction. Now, in Hayden and NRMA, the New South Wales Court of Appeal, composed entirely of judges from outside New South Wales, as it happened, said that that was not really the case. But in the more recent Victorian case of AJH Lawyers and Hammo, that appeared to be endorsed by Justice Nettle, with whom Justice Maxwell agreed. So it needs to be taken seriously as a possibility in this state, although as it happens, that comment was obiter, and ultimately the court rejected an argument that the law firm in that case had been negligent by failing to advise that resisting an action for winding up was pointless, in large part because the Court of Appeal said it wasn't pointless. And then I refer to David and David, which, you know, tends to follow Hayden and NRMA. There's also a point that the scope of your duty will vary depending on how sophisticated your client is. So in both Astley, Oz Trust and Astley, and National Home Loans Corporation, you had fairly sophisticated clients, people who did this on a regular basis. And therefore the court said, well, if you've got a sophisticated client who comes to you asking for advice about a specific point, you're probably safe to just advise them on the specific point. There's less scope to simply sort of imply a requirement to give additional advice, because they don't. Whereas if you had, for example, an elderly person of a non-English speaking background come in wanting to talk to you about guaranteeing a mortgage, you would want to give them pretty comprehensive advice about what all the risks were of entering into that transaction. So that does affect the duty of care. Now, the standard of care is pretty straightforward. It is a reasonable degree of care based on your area of expertise at the date of the alleged negligence. Importantly, it doesn't actually go higher if you hold yourself out as an expert. In Hayden, again, Justice Dyson Hayden, well, Dyson Hayden as he then was, Justice Hayden as he later was recognized as an expert in trade practice litigation. And it was held that he did not owe a higher standard of care simply by dint of that role. The duty always remains to exercise reasonable skill and care. And importantly, you don't do that simply by getting it wrong. In Strambrandt and Hanscom, which is referred there, a case against Ms. Hanscom SC, it was specifically stated that you're not negligent just because your advice is wrong. It's only if you fail to exercise reasonable skill and care. Turning to the issue of loss, that's governed by statute nowadays, the Wrongs Act. You just need to prove on the balance of probabilities that the negligence caused the loss, but it does raise an important issue, which is the next paragraph, which is loss of a chance. Many solicitors' negligence cases will involve a loss of a chance. For example, if a claim becomes statute barred so that the litigation cannot proceed, then the person will have lost the chance to pursue that litigation. In that case, the court conducts what it describes as a trial within a trial, where it sort of goes through all the aspects of the proceedings and sort of tries to figure out how much you'd have probably got in damages in the end, subject to various discounts for vicissitudes, lawyers' fees, those kinds of things. So, for example, in a case that's not actually mentioned here, a recent county court decision, White Cleland Proprietary Limited and Burgess Properties Proprietary Limited, case became statute barred, a debt claim for approximately $100,000, and the amount of damages awarded in that case was $15,000, despite a finding of negligence. So there is some scope for variation in terms of the awards that are being made. And finally, I'm just going to talk briefly about advocates' immunity. And the first point to make about advocates' immunity is that you do not want to rely upon advocates' immunity. It's great that it provides some immunity from suit, but the net effect of it is you will go through a long and involved trial only to have your defence made out. You would always rather not have to go through a trial. That said, it does exist and it does protect solicitors in respect of certain work, being work sort of that is, as a, the GNLE and Wraith quote is there, work done out of court which leads to a decision affecting the conduct of the case. So that's really, those are really the issues I want to discuss in relation to just negligence as a whole. I think now we've got a list of what we describe as common issues to look out for, and we're sort of trying to open it up to the floor a bit here. These are, as we say, common issues which do arise in negligence cases and disciplinary proceedings, and they're somewhat helpful in just trying to spot things before they happen and nip them in the bud. So,
The first thing that commonly leads to complaints is lack of communication, and that can result in either a complaint to the commissioner about a disciplinary matter or a negligence claim. Surprised clients are often unhappy clients, and clients who are kept in the loop and feel that you are looking out for their best interests are much less likely to make a complaint about you. And if they do make a complaint, the outcome will be a lot better if it can be shown that you were doing everything you could to do the right thing. And on a similar note, the next point that we have there is a soured relationship with a client is never a good thing. It not only can lead to complaints about you, but it can also lead to you're not doing your job as well as you might otherwise. Everyone's had one of those black files that they just don't want to open, but it's best to do something about that as early as you can, whether that means ending your retainer or speaking to a colleague and seeing if you can transfer the file to them. It's best to not let it get to the stage that it did in the case of Mills Oakley Lawyers and Huon Property Holdings, where the partner responsible for the file had a falling out with the client and essentially delegated all the remaining work to a senior associate who wasn't adequately equipped to handle the case. And things went very pear-shaped after that. The next issue that commonly leads to problems is costs and billing. Again, it's the surprise element that often leads to problems here. Costs disclosure is really important if you want to minimise the hassle to yourself. Make sure it's clear, make sure it's written in plain English, and make sure that you talk through it with your client. And if they're showing concerns, be open up front. You may not be able to tell them exactly what a file's going to cost, but you need to be clear on what the contingencies are and what the potential costs could be.
So another one, as we have there, is lack of clarity about who the client is. And again, we see this to some extent in Mills Oakley, where there's a sort of shading together of a client who is both a director of a company and a sort of private client. So in those kind of situations can really lead to questions about who your client are. Again, when you're acting for married couples, sometimes there are differences of opinion, that, for example, as to how to proceed. I've got a case at the moment where there is where that is an issue, and we have to be very careful about how to proceed. And particularly if it were later to be the case that one person wanted to settle and one didn't, we might have to look at seeking separate representation for one or the other members of the couple, which would obviously be quite difficult. Lack of clarity about scope of instructions and matters. So yes, you need to define your instructions, and this is brought home by a fairly recent decision of the Tasmanian Full Court, Doolan and Rencon, in which the court said, well, they were given pretty vague instructions, but they made no attempt to actually clarify or limit what their instructions were. And so ultimately, the solicitors in that case were found to be negligent, largely because they hadn't answered all the questions that were raised in these initial vague inquiries. If they just sat down and said, well, this is what we want answers on, well, what do you want answers on, then they would have narrowed the scope of their retainer and probably avoided liability for negligence. Supervision, another issue here. We keep coming back to Mills Oakley. We probably shouldn't be so mean to the firm, but there's a quote there that sets out really an issue. And again, this arises from the soured client relationship. So you can see how one thing flows into another.
On that supervision thing, perhaps unfortunately for Mills Oakley, I'm going to talk about them a little bit more. That case and a number of things that happened for that firm make it very clear that supervision is vital, and taking responsibility for your junior employees is really something you should be careful about. The quote that appears there relates to a particular partner and a particular senior associate who I won't name, but they, in that particular case, it was a negligence action, and it was found that the partner was negligent for not having supervised this quite junior senior associate properly. A similar issue relating to the same pair of people arose where Mills Oakley wrote to a tenant of a caravan park and told him to cease and desist from making defamatory comments about the owner of that caravan park. What they also asked the tenant to do was to ensure that his local member of parliament stopped making comments in parliament about the owner of the caravan park. And Mills Oakley were found to be in contempt of parliament for having breached the parliamentary privilege. And that was, for Mills Oakley, the final straw in losing their VWA contract, which obviously had enormous fallout for the firm and its employees. So just a reminder to supervise junior lawyers and make sure you read the correspondence they are sending out on your firm's letterhead.
A related issue that we don't actually list here, but frankly probably should have, is just expertise. If you don't have expertise in an area, you may need to be careful about taking on work in that area. I mean, you know, if someone comes to you with an admiralty claim, you know, you need to think, am I ready for an admiralty claim? And it may be that you'll be fine, you just need to brief an appropriate counsel or whatever, but expertise can be an issue in these things.
You're making me feel very nervous.
You're the appropriate counsel, aren't you, Paul? The next issue is pressured settlements. It's unavoidable when you're a litigator that you're going to have settlements at the door of court or settlements in a mediation where a good offer is made and you're urging your client to take it, but your client's showing some reluctance. And it's not improper to place a certain amount of pressure on a client to understand that an offer may be good or that they should make a particular offer to settle a case, but at the very least, if you can see that there's a likelihood that there might be negotiations at the door of court, it's well worth preparing your client in advance, discussing possible ranges of outcomes, and discussing the way that those sorts of negotiations tend to happen in advance of that hearing date, so that they're not taken by surprise or feeling like they're being ambushed by the pressured negotiations in those circumstances. Another thing on a very different sort of issue, but one that frequently arises in negligence actions, is solicitor's certificates of independent advice. These certificates were the fallout from Amadio and Garcia. Basically, to protect themselves, the banks now require that any guarantor who's giving a guarantee without any benefit from the transaction, so your elderly Italian parents or your wife, your special wife, as they would put it in Garcia, they require those people who are not getting a benefit from the transaction to have a certificate filled out by a lawyer saying, I've given this person independent legal advice about the potential consequences of this transaction. Frequently, the way it happens in practice is that the person picks up the guarantee, the mortgage, and the certificate from the bank, walks a couple of doors down to the local suburban solicitor's office, walks in and says, can you sign these documents for me? And unfortunately, there have been quite a few solicitors out there who just think it's a bit like witnessing and receiving an affidavit or a stat deck. And they'll sign away, charge the client $150, and end up with a massive claim for negligence against them. So it's really important, if you are a solicitor, that may possibly happen to at some point, make sure when someone comes in with a document like that you read it, and that you take a copy of it, and that you make a note of the advice that you gave, because if you don't have any records, then you're not going to win that case.
So the final issue is really just one of limitations. I mean, it's always just sensible when the file comes in to just check if there is a limitations issue here, because sometimes these things have been bouncing around for a very long time before they get to you, and it's true of barristers and solicitors, and you just, it always helps to check, because the last thing you want to do is to get sued because a claim went out of time on your watch. It's a fairly simple point, and in many cases it won't really be relevant, but it's always worth doing.
And sorry, this final point is file notes. Keep your file ordered. Make sure you archive your files in a way that makes them able to be found later. As a junior solicitor, I once was sent to the crawl space under a practitioner's mother's house to go through boxes of files that were in his archives. You might not be surprised to know that the file didn't turn up. So, for people like me, keep your files ordered.
Megan, what happens when you mentioned before about the LPLC, what happens when you open an envelope and there's a letter of complaint alleging that you've been negligent in some shape or form? You draw the attention of the LPLC as early as possible for good reason. What happens after that?
Yeah, well, the LPLC encourages lawyers to contact them as soon as possible. And one of the things that they will do is if you ring them up with I think something might have gone a bit wrong on this, I haven't actually received a claim or a letter of demand or anything like that yet, but I'm just a bit concerned, they'll happily discuss the matter with you. And you're not required to pay any deductibles or make any sort of official notification unless it's warranted in the circumstances. Once it's clear that there is a claim, then the LPLC will, generally speaking, instruct one of their panel solicitors. So they have a number of panel partners in firms, and they'll instruct them to conduct some investigations. They'll get the lawyer into the insured lawyer into the firm to take some initial instructions, perhaps dig out the file and go through it, do a quick review to make sure there's something that might give you a defence, and then they'll take it from there. Sometimes in the smaller matters, the LPLC do also handle the matters in-house. All of their claims managers are very experienced lawyers, so they also do handle some matters in-house, and especially in cases where there's a chance that the matter might be able to be resolved without the practitioner having to even pay their entire deductible, because those deductibles can be quite considerable, especially if there's a deterrent one in place which doubles your deductible in certain circumstances.
And these experiences can be fairly bruising. What happens in terms of the relationship between the insured solicitor and the LPLC, where the solicitor has quite properly given early notice to the insurer of the claim, but takes the view that the claim is a try-on and that there's been no negligence on the solicitor's own part, and encounters a different view within the LPLC? How are those sorts of issues resolved?
The really difficult issues, and they will be case specific. If the LPLC or their lawyers review the file, speak to the practitioners, and agree that there is a good defence, they certainly are not a soft touch when it comes to litigation. They also
are not allowed to settle a case without instructions from the insured, and that is always a difficult thing to manage, those conflicts between insured and insurer. But they do have provision, and we've all got the same policy and they're available online, but they all have provision for a it's if you don't agree to settle a matter and it's been recommended to you, you put yourself on risk. So the LPLC can, if they recommend a settlement offer and you don't agree to make it, then their liability is limited to that amount of the recommended settlement, and you then are liable for anything after that. The insurer will not settle any claim against any insured without the prior consent of the firm, but if the firm does not accept any recommendation for settlement by the insurer's liability will be limited to the amount of the settlement recommended plus costs and expenses up to the date upon which the recommendation was made. So
it that focuses tends to,
yes, sort things out, generally speaking.
Megan and Rupert, thank you very much for that introduction to our topic this morning.